This is David and Andy on the Run
on Red Radio.
In the summer of 2013, after George Zimmerman's acquittal for the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, the Black Lives Movement began with the hashtag, obviously hashtag Black Lives Matter. The movement was co-founded by three black community organizers, Alicia Garza, Patrice Coolers, and Opal Tometi. So, okay, that's just a little introduction. What do you guys think about the Black Lives Matter movement? What is it for those of us who don't know, and why is it important? Let's start off with Chloe.
So the Black Lives Matter movement is basically to highlight the injustice of racism within the police force in the U.S., police brutality, the thousands of lives that have been taken of innocent black people, and just to highlight that all lives matter will not matter until Black Lives Matter. Because in the U.S., black lives don't matter. And yeah, that's pretty much it.
But why is that relevant here? Like, why is that movement relevant here, and why is the hashtag relevant in South Africa?
I mean, I'm sure you've heard there are some cases in South Africa of police brutality, but I think this whole racism within the police force starts on a minor note. It starts with racism in your close community. It starts with these little conversations, these little assumptions.
Comments.
Comments. And those, and that mindset, and the truth is, I think, racism in itself isn't just hate. That's one manifestation of it, but it can come in so many different forms. It can be subconscious. We're born into this world, and we're not born with racism, but it's inevitable almost. That's what we face in our close community. So it's important to change that.
Absolutely. Sims?
For me, why it's really relevant here is because there's this thing, I think there's this misconception that there's a difference between an American black person and a South African black person. But meanwhile, black is black. It doesn't matter where you're living. So I feel like we're all fighting for the same purpose, for the same injustice. So it doesn't matter where you're living. And also, as Chloe mentioned, yes, we see racism happening here. And it's been so prevalent here. But it hasn't been that vivid as much as America. So I think this is a great opportunity for us to also speak on our racist things that are happening here, if you get what I'm saying.
But I get you.
It's just,
But then, okay, so, I mean, we can, okay, so we talk about Black Lives Matter and we use the hashtag and everything, but when we look within a South African context, most of the murders that happen in South Africa are black-on-black murders. And most of the murders that happen in the US are black-on-black murders. So what would you say to the argument that says we're focusing on the wrong things? Keely?
I mean, I think it's an interesting question, especially in South African context as well. But I think that it's not necessarily just a single black-on-black murder. I think it's the fact that the whole system is based on being advantageous to white people and disadvantageous to black people. And I think that that is really where this stems from. And obviously, you know, every single murder counts for something and every single person's life counts for something, but I think that it's important to know that it's based on a system and that that's where, you know, white privilege comes from. I think that that's important to take note. It's not necessarily the person who is killing the other person necessarily has to be a white person for it to be a racist action.
Absolutely. Ali, would you like to add anything to that?
So just upon a little bit of research, I wasn't even aware in my ignorance that there was a blacklivesmatter.com, and you can go on there and there are petitions you can sign. There are places where you can donate. It's pretty much the place you want to be if you want to be active in this whole campaign and this movement. Yeah. And so as you go onto the homepage, it says, this was obviously created on the 13th of July, 2013, where it comes from, where it's originated. And then right at the end, it says, this platform is used to combat violence and it is used to create a space for Black imagination and to center Black joy. And only when that has become a reality can we eradicate white supremacy, which I just think speaks so many volumes. And I think that's a really important concept which people need to start realizing needs to start happening.
The frustration that I have, right, is that, you know, we see these murders happening and then there's an uproar on social media and it feels like something is happening. and then like 3 weeks later we're back to normal life. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So for me, coming as from a Black person, it's really, really draining. And that's why, like, even thinking about the show, I was not looking forward to the show at all. Mm. Because just from my own experience, like, I've just been drained the past few days, you know, just talking about this so much. And, you know, you're trying to let people know what's happening, trying to let people know how you feel. But I don't think that anyone who's not of color or anyone who's non-Black will ever understand why, you know, why people are protesting so much, why people are rioting, which is something that we're going to get into, if they don't ask the questions and if they don't have that conversation.
I'm with you 100%. I'm 100% with you there, Dave. I think it kind of boils down to empathy and sympathy in a sense, because I can stand with you. I can 100% be by your side. I can fight. I can be in the protest supporting Black Lives Matter. Yeah. But I will never understand what it means to be someone who is non-white. I will never understand what it means to be a person of color. And so I think it's really important, like you said, to have conversations, to educate yourself. I can't put it out there in enough words, in enough ways, that education is so important in this time, especially as a white person. Yeah. Because I think everyone has a vague idea of what racism is. But if you actually just type into the Google search bar racism, or articles on racism, or podcasts on racism, it opens up a whole new world and a whole new perspective. And I think a lot of white people aren't actually educating themselves on the situation. And I think it's amazing that we have people taking to social media and being active. But what concerns me are people taking to social media from a place of, I want change, or are people taking to social media in a sense of, this will look good for me, this is what I can do to my bit, but it's not actually proactive. And so that's just my little two cents and my opinion on this whole situation. Simps, you have a point.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I feel like as a society, we are just overcomplicating racism. It's very simple. The thing that we need to educate ourselves on is how we can help mitigate racism. I think that's the problem here. It's because I feel we tell people, no, this is wrong, but then they say, but. I think that's the problem. That's what's overcomplicating racism. And it's not complex. Listen, educate yourself on how to mitigate the problem. That's my opinion on just.
And Chloe?
And I think what David brought up a point. He said people only for 3 weeks and then they move on with their lives. And I think that the reason people do that is because people aren't truly understanding the severity of this issue. I mean, I think I knew there was police brutality based on race in the US, but I don't think even me, I knew the extent to how common it was. These things are happening every single day. And although not each one results in death, people are being racially profiled. I mean, you see these videos of people being tased, beat up for no reason. Thank goodness their lives weren't taken. But the severity isn't shown. And I think specifically, you're learning about this in history, for example. You learn about the civil rights movement and it's like, oh, it's over. It's the 60s, 64, 68. That's when the movement, that's over, you know? And you're like, it's in the past, thank goodness. But it's not. It's still happening every day. And although we don't like to call it, it's lynching. It's happening every day.
I think something that's interesting is, I mean, as an IEB student, we learn about apartheid in grade 11. And when you're learning about it, you kind of go, well, why am I only learning about this when I'm 16 or 17 years old? I mean, I live in the country. Surely I should be educated on this when I'm, I don't know, 10, 11. But it's really, really weird because I sit in the classroom and I hear about the brutality of the police. I hear about the ignorance of the government. And I think, but that will never happen because that was 25 years ago and I live in a different South Africa now. And it's so hard for me to imagine that once was a reality for people.
I'm going to push back on that because I don't think that learning about apartheid in history, I don't think that any of the content that we learn about in history has a direct impact on mitigating racism within private schools.
Yeah,
I think that if we just look at the IEB, you know, schools around South Africa, around Johannesburg, all of these schools that have the IB syllabus, all of these students, all of these white students that are learning history, you know, these students still choose to be racist. These students still choose to, you know, they'll get A's in history and they'll get A's studying apartheid, but that doesn't actually do anything for changing their minds about racism, for changing their minds about the N-word, for changing their minds about white privilege. You know, it's almost as if, okay, we learn apartheid, it happened 26 years ago, now we're studying it, but it has no emotional impact on us. So I don't think that studying history is directly beneficial in this context, but that's just coming from me. Chloe, I know you wanted to add on that.
I was just going to comment on Ali's point, and what's so interesting is that, yeah, we learn about the specifics of, like, the movement in maybe apartheid at, like, our age. But what's so sad is that most Black kids learn this as soon as they can speak. They have to learn how they're going to be treated and how they have to react to these situations. Like, as soon as we're born, we have to know the situation. Otherwise, you're gonna die. You know, you have the risk of your life. So.
Yeah.
Which, again, is something that I will never be able to understand as a white person. And every day, I think, it's important to acknowledge that and accept that and try and work out a way in which you can challenge that and find a long-term solution. I'm so hell-bent on a long-term solution. But Killy, I know you had a point.
Hi, sorry. I also just like wanted to add as well, you know, when I was in high school, my mentality was just get the work done, memorize it, write a test and get an A, you know, and you know, often, especially with history, you're not actually thinking about what you're learning, and what you're learning is your country's history and the fact that what happened. And it's, for some people, it just sounds like a booklet that you have to memorize, and it's not actually an education other than that. And I think that that's something that, you know, when you are in grade 11, it's obviously placed there by the IEB as a way of you getting being mature person. Enough. That, but also like, you being mature enough now to actually digest the information, but people don't. And I think that that's why people don't change. And I think on top of having the environment of a mainly private school with wealthy people and, you know, private schools in Joburg are, you know, a lot of it is white communities and things. And, you know, people don't take what they learn about specifically in history and take it out to the outside societies and realize that, you know, that happened then and we shouldn't be doing it now. Because it's like two separate things. And I think that, you know, you should be learning what, you know, in the classroom and applying it outside.
But Julie, let me ask you something. Do you think that there is any course in the IB, whether it be ALO, history or whatever, that somewhat teaches children about the systematic racism that is in private schools, that is in our greater South Africa? Do you think there is any knowledge of that, any education of that in our system?
No, I absolutely don't think there is. I mean, I kind of only learnt about, you know, systematic racism and how to actually effectively change it and how I can use my words and how I can do that actively when I got to university. And not because I was taught it, but because I was put in an environment where it wasn't rich, wealthy white people everywhere.
100%.
And I think that that is something that, you know, everybody needs to be taught. And I think that, you know, LO specifically should be a subject where you do learn about that stuff, or in history it should be emphasized that this isn't a booklet to be memorized, or, you know, or things like that, or, you know, even learning it in biology. And, you know, some people think that, you know, different races are completely different biologically when you're not, you're human beings. And I think that, like, it needs to be reinforced within many subjects. And, you know in history, bring up, or in English, bring up famous Black poets and famous Black writers, because I can tell you right now, I looked back in my poetry section and all of them are white poets and things like that. And, you know, Black people aren't being celebrated in even the smallest ways in high school, and that doesn't teach people to appreciate them.
We get to Thomas and then we're going to go to music, just one last thing that I want to touch on is what I found when you know, students are studying ALO, whether it be my school and other schools, is that the level of education that you'll receive in ALO is limited to the demographic of, you know, the people that you're surrounded by. So if you're surrounded by a 70% white class, you know, the conversation is going to sway more towards their opinion, you know. So that's why I have trouble with these ALO conversations, is that if I speak up about a conversation, if I speak up about a topic, you know, that's, say, pro Black Lives Matter, and the rest of the class, you know, 70% white, will agree with me because that's the politically correct thing to do, but they won't actually believe what I'm saying. Or on the contrary, for example, I obviously am in the Zulu class. So in Ulo, what we found is that our discussions are, you know, a little bit more, how do I put this? Liberal in that aspect, you know? And that's literally something that we found. Whereas if you go to the because obviously my Zulu class is made up of a lot of people of color. Whereas if you go to the classes that aren't, you know, the demographics are mostly white people, then the conversation shifts, you know? And that's where I think the problem is, because you're not actually gaining any knowledge. Do you know what I'm saying? Thomas?
Yeah, I agree. One of the points that I wanted to bring up is, I think as a society we've become so used to instant gratification and, you know, there being an outcome for things so quickly. And I think I've seen a lot of people say, wow, this movement is really great. You know, when's it going to end? When's it all going to be over?
Yeah.
And I think it needs to be enforced by so many of us that this is something that needs to be ongoing and something that we need to look at, because I mean, if you look when I'm talking about the movement in terms of social media, if you look at social media, it's trends and it's upwards and downwards. And I think as a society, we need to say, when we see it going downwards, we need to lift it up and maybe keep it at a constant.
Absolutely.
And I think, you know, it's important to say that this is not something that's going to be fixed in 20 years' time. This is not something that's going to be fixed in 50 years' time. But it's going to be a problem for a very, very long time. But I think if people can accept, first of all, that this is something that's not going to just go away by posting on social media. It's about keeping on educating yourself. It's about keeping on educating others when you have the time and keeping the conversation going. And I think if you can accept that,
definitely,
then there can be a lot more improvement in the mindset around it, you know.
Yeah, I'm with you. Right. Yeah. So I love what you're saying.
I love what you're saying, Tom, about keeping the conversation going. I do think, however, that it's a lot more difficult than that. I think that in the past we've tried to say keep the conversation going, whether it's about, you know, the Men Are Trash movement, what happened last year with the whole uproar. But I think it's very difficult to keep the conversation going.
I agree.
And I'd love to talk about that more after the break, as well as we're going to be discussing things like reverse racism and the dynamics of growing up black in a private school.
Red Radio.
Broadcasting live 24/7.
David and Ali on the run. On Red Radio.
Alrighty, guys, and we are back for the second round of conversation. And I'd like to start off with Simpiwe. Simps, just final thoughts on the last conversation about, you know, conversations in school, whether it's in Ulo, whether it's in history. How effective do you think those are?
Okay. So I feel like right now there's this thing of this whole thing is a new thing. It's this racism is new. That's how people are acting right now. And I feel like it's partially to blame with the educational system not knowing how to empathize and now being oblivious to what's happening, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's just on my point.
And since you had one, I know you had a point you wanted to bring up in the next segment. So I don't know if you want to take the wheel and drive this one.
Okay, sure. So this question of, can Black people be racist? Okay. What I'm about to say is backed up with research, so I'm not just like saying out of the blue. Let's look at the definition of racism. Prejudice, discrimination, or antagonism directed against someone of a different race based on the belief that one's own race is superior. So let us just digest that. First of all, how can I be racist to a white person when their beliefs and their race is seen to be superior into today's world? Mm-hmm. How can I do that when their culture and their, how can I say, just how they are basically has been indoctrinated in our lives as right? Take a look at colorism.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
take a look at capitalism. That's my point. We can't be racist to, and then it says that one's own race is superior. First of all, as we can see, our race is not superior.
Yeah.
So what basis can we say that, you know, how can we be racist to, I can't explain, I'm sorry. Like, how can we be racist to an inferior, how can I say, an inferior race? You know what I mean?
You're coming across. I think people understand what you're saying.
And then my thing is, Black people can be prejudiced. And now let's look at the word prejudice. It's a preconceived opinion that is not based on reason or actual experience.
Yeah.
For example, the reason why we are prejudiced is due to all the actions that have been indoctrinated in us. The silence, when we have been silenced. So we have this preconceived opinion of white people due to what has happened in the past, due to apartheid, due to slavery, and many more discriminatory actions that have happened towards our race. So that's the difference for me. Anyone else want to add?
Chloe?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think, first of all, when speaking about like racism, I think we're talking about Black on white, right? We're talking about, can a Black person be racist to a white person? And I think, you know, you said the definition of racism, right? But I think it's a little bigger than that even. I think often people only think it's this, you know, this hate or something. Racism is like a complex system, you know, of all these like social and political aspects. You can't dismiss, okay, all because at the hands of like someone of color or something, there's occasional mistreatment to white people. You can't compare that to the systematic and institutionalized racism that has been pushed for years. Racial prejudice, as SMP said, yes, I can say, I don't know, you know, white people can't dance or something, but that's not racism, that's racial prejudice, because racism is bigger than simple hate.
Yeah.
That is one manifestation. Yeah.
I think where, you know, I heard it somewhere like this. Racism is when the person being racist has the power to affect the life of the person with whom they are, you know, being racist towards. So has the power to affect their mental health, has the power to affect their standard of living, which is where we get into the conversation of institutionalized racism. And I also think this conversation about the BE is very interesting. Because I do know that there is opposition to the system of the BEE by a white perspective, that the BEE is not a fair practice because it does not give equal opportunity to all. Kini, what would you have to say on those lines?
Oh, thank you. I completely agree with all of you. You know, as a white person, I can completely agree that reverse racism is not a thing at all. And I think that, you know, yeah, there's a difference between racism and prejudice. But regarding the BEE and, you know, people now saying that it now gives unequal, you know, opportunities for white people to, you know, get a job or get to university and things like that. But the thing is that, you know, for so many years, people of color and Black people haven't had that opportunity, and now they are disadvantaged now. And that is exactly what the BEE is supposed to do, to be able to enable them to be able to affect change and to be able to get the education and the job that they need to empower themselves. And I think I'm fully supportive of the BEE program because it now needs to, because of the disadvantage that people of color and Black people have had for so long, this is a stepping stone to making sure that they are higher up and they're regarded as higher up and are as equals. I'm not saying that it is.
Definitely.
You know, now I agree that there's so much more to do before we get there, but I think this is a stepping stone to getting there. And people who, you know, are against it really haven't thought about the fact that it's not today. There's a whole history that needs to be taken into account as well.
But then what would you say to the person who says, okay, but why don't we hire the best person for the job so that ABC, you know, the company can perform at its best level and so that society can move forward in the best capacity that it can? What would you say to that person?
I mean, and I understand their frustration and that's cool. But the thing is that, number one, that assumes that the Black person is less qualified, which isn't true. Number two, it doesn't necessarily mean that even if they are less qualified in this, like, let's just take the case, if they are less qualified, doesn't necessarily mean that they can't be taught to become more qualified. And that opportunity needs to be given to them. Just because they start off as less qualified doesn't mean that they can't do a better job when they are taught. And I think that that is something that needs to be taken into account. Because there needs to be... Sorry, Chloe, you can go.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say also, in terms of, they say, let's hire the best person. Yes, you're looking at how they can do the job, but sometimes the best person is the person of color, because if you're in a company and 90% of the people are white, but you're providing a service or a product that's going to go to a lot of black people, and the only people looking at this product or service are white people, then no, you need someone of color to have their opinions on it so that it can be the best product or service.
Exactly. You can't only look at it from a qualifications point of view.
Exactly. There's so many other aspects.
So many nuances.
Does that also apply within the context of school when we're electing head boy, head girl, deputies, house captains? Should that also be considered?
Oh,
100%.
And
why? 100%. 100%. Why though? Why?
David, I think in the same sense that you have a head boy and a head girl, because it's two different minds. You and I have two different minds based on the pure and simple reason that you are a boy and I'm a girl. I hate to admit it, but we do. And so you have a head boy and a head girl. And for that exact same reason, you need to have a diverse range of minds collaborating to form the best product, in inverted commas, because at the end of the day, if you have like-minded people, as you've said, in the LO conversations, you have a conversation swaying to one way. But then you have maybe a more diverse group of students having a conversation, and you can come up with a more liberal idea or solution. Or I just think, Killy wants to add to this. So Killy?
I just wanted to add, in the context of specifically, you know, the forehead prefix, I think you can't have four white people or four black people. How are you supposed to, you know, represent a school that is multiracial if you're all one race? And I think that, you know, celebrating simple things like Heritage Day, and where you are the four representatives of the school, you need to have four separate identities and four separate, you know, heritages and cultures. And I think that that is important. And you can't just have four white people just because they might be the most four qualified. They're not.
Yeah.
It's too narrow-minded in that sense.
Yeah,
exactly.
A conversation I heard, and I was quite, you know, and it sparked a lot of interest for me, because a lot of the conversation comes around is you know, within Red Hill, let's look at Red Hill. Obviously, it's majority white. If you look at the demographics of it, however, when people are talking about leadership and head boys and head girls, and they are throwing names out there, one person will say, "But you know, why we need to put someone black in there," and that even goes back to the institutionalized racism, because that shows that we are taking that society hasn't progressed enough where we can, you know, put where it's white, but actually no, we need to take someone out to put black in just to fit the quotas. And that is a massive, massive problem. That shows that it's going much more subconsciously than we know. And that shows that we need to dig it up much deeper than we know, because it's disgusting that we still have these preconceived misconceptions in our head of who we view as of leadership. And just to fit a quota, we're going to take someone out and put somebody else in, you know?
But Tom, I mean, I wouldn't think that... I guess I'm viewing it from a different perspective, because I would think that having a diverse, you know, heads of school and intentionally doing that, like actually thinking about it, is actually a good decision. And I'll tell you why. When I was in grade one and I was growing up, if I were to look at the heads of school, I wouldn't see anybody that looks like me. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, when you're growing up and you're growing up in private school, you learn a lot from your surroundings, and we'll get to that in a moment. But I think that it's so important to intentionally pick people of color for these positions if you want to create a school which has free thinkers. Right?
I get that. But what I'm saying is, why in our heads has it gotten to the point where the people that have been put in there first and foremost in a lot of conversations is white people? Why is that the main conversation? Why is that someone that, why has there, you have to look at Red Hill, why for so many years has there been a major, major majority of white leadership? Why is that? What are the preconceived misconceptions? What are our the deeply entrenched racism that goes beneath this layer of what we view people on the outside, but what's it going into on the inside? I mean, where are these ideas being put into our head that that's how we view it?
Oh, absolutely. Okay, after the break, I want to get into a conversation more specifically around what's been going on in the last 7 days and the response by private schools. You can actually phone us in on 011-083-8426. We'll be back after this song.
Right, guys, we are back for our third segment of our show. Thank you so much for staying with us. We are loving having this conversation. I want to throw it to, I think, Simpiwe wants to chat a little bit about what's going on in the world and what's been happening the past 7 days. So, Sims, if you want to start us off.
Okay, sure. So, as we all know, there's this Blackout Tuesday, people being called out for being silent, taking up the hashtag Black Lives hashtag. So where do you want me to start? So there's just so much.
I want to know, everybody knows what's been happening. Everybody's been seeing the posts or pretending to ignore the posts, one of the two, right? So I want to know, is the response by white private school students sufficient? And if not, what are the effects of their silence?
Okay. For me, what I've been at, okay, so let me just start from the beginning. I've been asking people why they are silent, okay? Mm-hmm. And some people have said to me that it's because either they're not on social media a lot, or they said they don't feel like they have to show their advocacy on social media. They can do it somewhere else. And just to add on that, your platform can reach so many other people. You know, it doesn't, how can I say, like social media, okay, for me, what I can say is if you post with understanding, if you're posting not to feel good about yourself, if you're posting for change and for your heart and your care for us, then I think you can post. But the reason why people are like, no, I don't feel like it because I'll be scrutinized, I feel like that's no, because that would mean that you're posting for our validity. For our validity instead of posting to create a change. You don't have to post what's called all the videos and stuff. Post solutions. Post as, I said this to some people, post as a white person. Post how you can use your white privilege. Post petitions. You guys need to start the campaigns. You don't have to wait for us, you know? You guys need to start this conversation. You don't have to wait for us. It's by you guys taking the initiative. That's how I feel it can be so effective, not just post and we'll see later. No. You know what I mean?
Chloe?
Does that make sense?
Yeah, you did.
I was going to say that where my kind of frustration came in was that people saw this video, we all did, and lots of people were saying I was so heartbroken, okay? And I was heartbroken too. And not only that, I was scared, I felt in danger, but I felt so angry, okay? I felt like outraged. And so I think we talk about there's so many lanes of protest that we can participate in. And a part of it is educating yourself. A part of it is having these important conversations. About the conversations, we need to make sure we're not just having them with white people and your white family and your white friends. You need other perspectives, first of all. Second of all, if there are different lanes, but if you are so angry, what's happening? Like every day I see these videos, I can't bear myself. If you're so angry, why can't you use every single lane? Every single lane possible, I will use to stop this, to educate people. I think that's where the frustration came.
And Kelly,
you know, this, it's been very frustrating for me, because obviously I saw the video as well. I was extremely outraged and I hated it, and it was painful for me to see, and I'm not even under attack myself. But you know what frustrates me the most is that you know, these people in my grade specifically, I mean, that's kind of the main people that I follow, they are around and, you know, they're online. That's the problem, is that you know, their defense is that they don't post on social media, but they're online, they're watching the stories, but there's so much silence from them.
Yeah.
And I just hate that, you know, people are saying that it's just not worth ruining their aesthetic of their Instagram. I mean, when last was anybody's aesthetic of their Instagram having to talk about an innocent man dying? No one's aesthetic is that, you know? And I just think that, you know, this is the time, you know, you pride yourself on having 2,000, 3,000 followers. This is the time when you should be proud of having that and that you can reach so many people. I don't care about you running on a treadmill or the flowers that you got, you know? Exactly. The 3,000 people at this time don't either, and rather use the platform to actually educate yourself. I spend so much time educating myself this week because at the beginning of this week, I wasn't qualified to be talking as counterparts and you, all of you guys were, and I needed to make sure that I was educated to be able to educate other people, because it's not your job to educate me, it's myself. And I've done that and I've learned so much and I've shared education resources, and it just doesn't seem like people care. And then you ask them, white people, you ask them, well, you know, then you're racist, and they said, no, but I have a black friend. And I'm like, cool. So your token black friend to prove that you're not a racist, but why are you not advocating for them? Because you're still not advocating for them, which, you know, maybe doesn't make you racist, but it makes you extremely ignorant. And it's frustrated me a lot. And it really, you know, now you have this platform and you're not using it. And it really frustrates me. And I think that, you know, this is the time to use it. Social media isn't about sharing about your dog. You know, we can't go outside. We can't protest because, you know, we are in a global pandemic and you can't. And now it's illegal to protest in South Africa. And you've got to now use that. And as Chloe said, you know, use all the lanes. Why do you only have to stick to one lane? And I think that you need to use it. You need to be vocal, because you can't be vocal out on the streets. So be vocal on social media.
Yeah.
So
something which might come across as a little bit controversial is when this whole thing exploded on social media, which I'm sure people who know me quite well know that I'm a little bit afraid of social media, in the sense that I think it is a very dangerous platform, in the same sense that it is equally as beautiful and powerful and important in everyone's life. And so when everything took to social media, I was a little bit like taken aback. I didn't know what I should do as someone who will never fully understand what it's like to be someone who is not white. I was confused, I was angry, I was upset, and I didn't know what to do with myself and with my privilege. And so I took to internet and I took to research and articles and podcasts. And unfortunately, I haven't read any books yet, but I hope to one day. And for me, the most important thing I could do for myself, and hopefully in doing justice for any person of color I know, was educate myself on how I can use my white privilege. And something I came across as what I think is a very important resource for anyone who's not entirely sure what white privilege is or how they can use their white privilege is... there's this woman, and now her name slipped my mind, Peggy McIntosh, who is actually 85 years old. And she has been involved in many, many activist movements. She's a feminist. She's American. She's a feminist. She's a very influential person in terms of racism and, well, anti-racism. And she's put together this almost quiz, I guess you could call it, on how am I privileged and do I know, like, how do I acknowledge my privilege? And something that kind of shocked me was, like, one of the questions said, can you turn on the TV or open a book or a magazine, and is your race supported? Do you see a lot of people who look like you? And I don't think about that. Like, it's such an ignorant thing to say, and I'm admitting it. I don't think about that. But when David mentioned a couple minutes ago, when he was in grade one and he saw his four heads of school, they didn't look like him. And what does that do to someone's self-esteem? How is that justifiable? And so I'm putting out a little bit of my two cents into the world right now. And I'm saying that I found it so helpful to educate myself on the situation and to educate myself on my own privilege and where I stand in society as a white person. Because to be honest, I think a lot of people are living in, it's blissful to not know what's going on in the world. It's easier to ignore it. It's easier to just turn off my phone and ignore what's happening outside. So that's
Coming from my side, I think this means a lot more than the last 7 days, right? like for me and for a lot of people in the Black community that have grown up in private schools, it means like from the age of 5 years old, like recognizing that you're Black and trying to fit in more, you know?
Mm.
Like I remember being at picture day and my grandma would come with me for picture day and I would be ashamed to have my own grandmother next to me because she looked too African. And she didn't look like the other grandmothers, you know. I remember changing my accent from grade one. In grade one, being 7 years old, changing my accent to speak to my white crush so I could, you know, kind of be more white, you know. It's that's why I say Black children in private school in private schools and white children in private schools grow up with a different reality. Mm. Because what Black children have to realize from a really young age is they have to begin this fight to fit in. And that comes at a cost of sacrificing your own identity and your own heritage. Mm-hmm. And then you're left at 17 years old, 16 years old, you know, trying to unravel that, being like, oh, goodness, you know, I have neglected this my whole life. Let me try and unravel that and let me start to learn my skin color. And that's not an easy thing, you know. And so I think it's great that we're having these conversations, but this is not just about the last 7 days.
Mm-mm.
You know, in grade seven, you know, I didn't know how to defend myself when one of my white friends would call me the effing K word, you know, at break. Like all you can do is laugh in that moment because you don't know, I don't know how to defend myself around a whole other bunch of white kids, you know, like, so that's why I think that when we focus on the last 7 days and that's what we think about, oh my goodness, I didn't post in the last 7 days. Oh my goodness, I didn't reach out to this person in the last 7 days. It's so much more than that. It's about the fact that we've been in high school for 2.5 years. We've been conscious of racism for about 2.5 years at least, right? And white people in private schools do not take the initiative to, you know, ask their Black friends about their experiences, to ask their Black friends about, you know, what are you hurting about? What have you gone through?
Mm.
And, you know, we just bear witness to the racism going around us and we don't say a thing, you know? And then that just leaves Black children to try and fit in more, try and fit in more, try and fit in more, and ignore these things that come their way, you know, ignore all of this subtle racism that comes their way. And so when things like this happen and people are like, oh no, I don't post on social media because of my aesthetic. Oh, wow. Like it feels really good to be uncomfortable. You know what I mean? Like Black people have been uncomfortable for an extremely long time. That was just my little two cents. Would anyone like to add to that?
It's just, I get you, but also just because we're closing off now, I think we should also like applaud the people that have been educating themselves, 100%. The people that have been asking questions, the people that have been taking initiative, because at the end of it all, that's the goal, for us to all work together to end racism, to potentially end racism. So
Yeah. I think there's a long way to go. I don't know if we've even come a long way, but I definitely think that by doing little things like this, we are definitely making a change in someone's life, whether it be big or small. And so I want to say thank you to everyone for joining us and for being honest, because that takes a lot of gut to come on here and talk to whoever many people are listening, however many people are listening. So yeah, thanks to Chloe, Simps and Killy for joining us today. David, Thomas and I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's it from Red Radio for today.